Okay, Samani Lotti, can you hear me now?
Yeah, like I lost you for 3 seconds. So.
Welcome to a new episode of the Lighthouse Conversations. I'm Hesham Montasser, speaking to you from my home in Dubai. It's been almost 2 months now since we started our home quarantine. Unlike many of you, this period has had its ups and downs for me. And mostly, I've tried to use it as an opportunity, connect with friends, and also reflect on my own work. As many of you know, the F&B industry has been particularly hard hit. So for those of you in the industry or who want to learn more about how we're dealing with it, the steps we're taking, etc., feel free to connect with me directly, either on Instagram at Montahas or by sending an email to hesham@thelighthouse.ae. We're continuing to connect with some of our internationally based guests who are doing some interesting work in the areas of arts, culture, tech, and of course, food. And today's guest is connected to a city that's very dear to my heart, New York City. I've spent 5 years in New York City after college working on Wall Street, and I must admit that this was one of the most interesting periods of my life, whether it was work, play, or anything in between. As regular listeners of the show know, I used to be a banker before I started The Lighthouse, and that's how I met Chris Khalifa, who worked with me as part of the asset management team at EFG in the late 2000s. Chris then left the industry to open up Zuba, a restaurant focused on taking true Egyptian street food to the world. Their story is a very interesting one and has taken Zuba from its hometown in Cairo all the way to New York City. Zuba initially expanded very quickly, in hindsight too quickly, which didn't turn out very well at the beginning. But kudos to Chris and the Zuba team. They put their heads down, consolidated, took on key lessons from the initial expansion. 10 years later, they have built a successful and highly recognizable, some would even say iconic brand in Egypt. Now, we've recorded this episode with Chris a couple of months ago, before we found ourselves in the middle of a pandemic and the various precautionary measures that took place around the world. After COVID-19, Zuba shut down its locations in Egypt and New York, so we wanted to check in with Chris to get an update on the impact the situation has had on Zuba.
Beginning of March, Zuba got listed on the 3rd of March on New York City's Bon Appetit's New York City's Best 100 Restaurants. 12 days after that, we closed our New York location, and a week after that, we closed all our Egypt locations because of the coronavirus. So that's been quite an interesting process. I think the transition from being so aggressively thinking about the business in terms of growth and being in such an exciting state of hitting milestone after milestone that we never dreamt of, to suddenly within 7 days or 10 days shifting the psychology from growth to survival has been quite the experience. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like it since we started Zuba.
Let's take a step back from that to how Zuba was started. So after spending 7 years being a banker, Chris felt the entrepreneurial itch he's experienced many times as a child.
I can recall conversations as young as high school with my mother about, you know, if we start this project and rent this soccer field and, you know, this many teams come and we do a tournament, we could do a project that does X, Y, Z. My memories steer more towards those types of passions. I have a passion for food, of course. I mean, we're the type of family where we plan our vacations around booking breakfast, lunch, and dinner in places and can spend months and months researching it. But I don't think that was at the core of me starting Zuba. That could have been a hobby and I could have started a different business.
And then how did Zuba specifically come to fruition as an idea?
Well, okay, when you look at, if you want to start your own thing, there's some parameters that I think you have to kind of check the box on. First of all, you have to start something that is, if you have a vision to grow it and aggressive vision to build a business around it, you have to be able to have enough capital to start it, for starters. So it's not very feasible to say, I want to start a cement plant as your first project, you know, and you need $100 million for that. So I think retail in general has the ability to start something small that you really can scale up with time. I'm also obsessed with brand building, and I believe in the power of brands and the moment brand create to building a business. And I started to see companies like Chipotle at the time, until today, to be honest, and retail companies in Turkey that we were looking at, like BIM, et cetera, that were growing at amazing rates and doing things that were amazing and building these cultures that stood for more than what their product was. So that's really what sparked the opportunity of, you know, why are all of our restaurants in Egypt imported brands, and outside of Egypt, why do we not exist whilst having such a rich history and culture where every single person on the planet knows who Egypt is.
So you had the idea, and then what gave you the final push? I keep going back to this only because I know that those transitions aren't easy. I mean, I went through something similar even later in my career than you did. The idea was formed in your head. What gave you that final push? Because you're leaving a very comfortable job that's well-paying, you're well-regarded. So what gave you that push?
Well, I think different, obviously different personalities have different risk tolerances. I mean, that's obviously a very a clear sure. fact on there. I always just looked at it as a different career trajectory and a different step. And I viewed it as, I never thought that if it didn't work, I'd be in the streets. And I thought it was an exciting thing to try. And it was something that, you know, if I grew it and I was successful at it, it would be adding a lot of value to myself. I mean human capital value, I don't mean financial value, and probably value that I could use whether it worked or didn't work in some other part of my career. When I started it, I was 28. So everything you have by the time you're 28 should not be in the context of the rest of your life too scary compared to everything you might otherwise build. And I just never obsessed about the transition as being the tough part. I think for me, the tough part was always finding something that had enough of the unique proposition and that I was passionate enough about to actually say, I want to do this.
You just mentioned this twice. So, I mean, you had done something before banking, right? Briefly, just curious to what was that about? And then you still went out to your point and went and started with Zuba.
Yeah, in between. So I spent 3 years on the advisory side at EFG. Correct. And after that, that was right after that, I left, right after I got married, actually, to my wife and my wife's family's horror, left to start my first potential venture, which at the time was to start a health food concept, kind of a salads and sandwich concept, and spent a year working on it, a year basically unemployed, trying to put it together to build it out, to put the team, all the different parts of starting up a company. And it didn't really come together. It started to become very obvious that this was very difficult from a supply chain standpoint to do at the time. And it was not as scalable as something I would have loved to do. I applied again for jobs and got another job at the time. Actually, you hired me, Hesham.
No, correct. So I was going to just say that that's a very important point because, and hopefully he listened to this, that your second manager, which is me, was far better than your first one, which is a common friend of ours.
Yeah, I can't. So, I won't go there.
Okay, I'm gonna try to keep this on. I'm gonna try to tell Chirag to keep this on the podcast so that Ashraf actually hears it. But
it wasn't the end of the world. I tried it, and when I was applying for jobs after that, it's not anyone I spoke to for a position did not tell me, oh, you left the job for a year, you're unemployable anymore.
And what's interesting is just to put it in perspective, the jump to start Zuba. I mean, this is post-revolution Egypt, right? Position Cairo at that point. How was that? Just kind of give us a sense of the environment when you were launching.
So that was definitely a tough part for sure. So he started working on the concept in 2010, and then the revolution happened beginning of 2011. And we obviously, just like the entire country did, put everything on hold. I came to a realization, I think I put it on hold for about 5 or 6 months, and then just kind of came to the realization that people are going to have to keep eating and life's going to go on. And this is being in the I didn't know if any of the jobs were a secure job anyway. And it might as well, if we're going to be secure, to be serving people food. It felt as secure as anything else. So we started again towards the end of 2011, found our location, October 2011. And I left EFG December 2011. So the revolution definitely put a pause for a few months on everything, but we quickly went back to it.
And then what happened? So you guys grew quite fast, right, at the beginning especially. And then you hit, obviously became very instantly, if I remember, really well-liked, very popular, well-known to your credit. But then you expanded very fast and then you hit some roadblocks along the way. So talk us a little bit through that first phase of expansion and then sort of, I don't want to call it a correction, but where did you go from there when you started making some adjustments?
It's we got, I think, so for me, just to define great response, for me, great response means that people either love you or hate you. If people are right. indifferent about whatever you're doing, then you're
not doing
die.
Your job.
We garnered emotional responses on both ends. People were either so proud of what we were doing and loved everything about what we were trying to do with Zuba, to the extent where they would forgive us for endless mistakes that operationally we were still learning and making, like ordering a full sandwich that could take 45 minutes instead of 3 minutes to prepare. Or people thought that we were, you know, the worst thing to happen to Egyptian food, because how dare we price more expensive items than people are used to eating. Everyone's entitled to their opinion on these things. But I think that reaction was really the beginning of us saying, you know, we're onto something here and there's something special about what we're doing. And then we could see it as well from obviously customers walking in, and that's really what it's about at the end of the day. But also press, the PR we were starting to get, the recognition we were getting by getting features on places like CNN has done more than one feature on us. Every publications all over the world and publications in Egypt talking about us. So it became very clear within the first 3-4 months that, you know, we've hit something that's special here and something that's emotional. So we started then to see, okay, what are our plans? What's our vision for this? What's our mission for this? What's our mission and vision here? What is drafting out the values, which we'll get into more detail, I'm sure, about here in the culture of the business, but starting to scale it out. And we opened our second location towards the beginning of end of 2013. So we did spend almost 2 years with just one location, which I think was the right decision for sure. But then we opened a second location almost 2 years in, third location a few months after that, and then a fourth and a fifth within a year after that. That took us into about 2015, and that's where we really started to feel our first roadblock.
What was the issue? Was it that you expanded too fast? You were stretching yourself in terms of human capital? I mean, just to understand a bit, how did you find roadblock?
I think we made every mistake. I think we, in a few things, we got very excited about the momentum of the beginning, and we raised around the capital right after that first round, and it felt like nothing that we do could be
go wrong.
Nothing can go wrong. We became less obsessive, or myself, and this is my mistake, about actual cash management and what the reality of just having cash is in a business versus growth. And I think this might be the transition for me from a banker mentality to a startup mentality. Probably started around that time where I realized that it's not about the Excel sheet P&L. It's simply about cash. And we built a couple locations, I think, a bit too fast, that without necessarily knowing what exactly our model was. I think the general, just understanding who our customers were and how our customers were interacting with us, we needed to spend a lot more time on. And we ended up with a location 4 and 5. 5 was the first location we ever closed, which was the biggest investment we made. And 4 ramping up much, much, much slower than expected. And in the meantime, and in the process, ended up with the 2015, where we were burning at the time what felt like obscene amounts of cash on a monthly basis that we simply weren't ready for.
I mean, but to your credit, you pulled through it. And actually, what I remember in those early days as a kind of consumer and obviously fan of your brand is when you launched, how incredibly thoughtful it all felt in terms of the brand building. So what was so interesting about ultimately what's a fast casual new brand is that it seemed you guys spent a lot of time thinking about the different elements and the building blocks of the brand, not just the food, but everything. So I'm talking about the design, the packaging, the concept. While obviously, like many other startups, you ran into some difficulties at some point, that really has withstood the test of time because it was built sort of in a timeless way.
Yes, for sure. I think the brand and interior for me are intertwined, but definitely they come from two different competencies, but they come in together. I think from day one, the people that we worked with on creating those were excellent. I think we invested more at every phase of our existence than our peers would have expected any company like us would invest in that branding. I mean, we're a company today that doesn't have a marketing director, but has a creative director. Mm. And I think that we were very aware of a couple things from the onset, and one of them is the importance of becoming a brand and not a restaurant.
That's exactly
and
right.
The idea that brands are emotional, and the idea that we have to stand for something as a brand And it's not, branding is not about looking pretty. And I think we've kind of put our money where our mouth is there. I think,
yeah, and, I mean, and one it, sees it that. Comes, I mean, when I go to your Instagram page, which I love, sorry to interrupt you. I mean, what, yeah, one of the things that's very striking is very clearly it's a lifestyle brand. It's not just, you're not just showing me the latest food sandwich. You know, you're really giving me a holistic view of the brand, which I either will connect with or not. But if you do, that makes a far stronger connection.
100%. I mean, I think it's again, it's about this idea of standing for more than food. I think that if Zuba tomorrow was selling, started a clothing line, no one would find that it doesn't fit with the brand, with the brand itself. It's something that we're probably going to do very soon. The most time we really felt that, you know what, I think we've done something special with this was definitely the opening of New York. I think the response of people to us opening, people that we don't know, people that we've never met, that just have some affinity to us as a brand, and some, whether it's pride, whether it's Egyptian pride, something of the sort, was overwhelming. And I think that's the first time that we felt that, you know what, really everything that we've done about creating this as a brand and everything we're standing for as a brand here is paying off. And we have that kind of emotional support from customers.
Well, I thought that's brilliant, because, I mean, so you went, kind of going back to the story, so you stabilized it in Egypt, obviously you were doing well, and then you were like, well, hey, let's go to New York. I mean, you know, the typical response would be maybe, you know, go to, I mean, you, that's a big jump. And again, testament to the strength of the brand, they were able to do that. So talk us a little bit through that thought process. What moved you from Cairo to New York?
That's a very long thought process.
give us the short version, the podcast version.
The response to anyone that we spoke to, whether it was advisory board members, even initially our own board and investors, and anyone else that we said, you know what, we think that our second location outside of Cairo should be in New York, thought that we were kind of losing our minds. For a combination of reasons. First of all, none of us have any operating experience about anything to do with New York. And second of all, we're at a point where we're trying to say, let's scale out the business and where's the next space? And we're coming from a country where 99% of the time, the next location is somewhere in the Gulf. So New York was definitely a stretch, let alone the fact that it's probably the most competitive food city on the planet. Well, now that I started with that, anything I say after that's going to seem like was just a crazy decision. But for us, there was a couple of things. We genuinely believed that we had something special in New York that stands out. And I still believe that. And I think that it's very rare to have a proposition that can be unique in markets like New York. And if you have that opportunity in any given time, I think you should take it. I think a big part of that is luck. I happened to be born in Egypt and we started an Egyptian concept. And then on a personal level as well, New York versus, we looked at other markets like London and as well, of course, Dubai. But I also know New York well, and my mother's from New York. We've come back every summer. So there was a sense of, this is a neighborhood that I actually know. I know the streets. I know where it is. I'd like to be here. You know, you make these decisions and you also move your family here and your kids here. And it's a big life decision. Sure. So all those came together and led us to doing it.
And how has the response been since you've launched?
It's been, we opened end of September, 27th of September.
Amazing.
From the start, the response in the lead up to our opening from Egyptians around all over Egypt on Instagram, on Facebook, and all over New York and the surrounding boroughs, Manhattan and New Jersey and the surrounding areas, was quite spectacular. I mean, the amount of people sharing our posts and the amount of people posting about it themselves that have never met me or potentially never even eaten at Zuba, but just had this sense of pride of something Egyptian coming from Egypt and opening somewhere that they would like to take their friends and say, look, this is Egypt. That was overwhelming. And then our opening weekend was quite insane. We had much more people come than we had ever anticipated, to the point where we ran out of food 2 days in, which might be a testament to bad planning from our side, but was also quite overwhelming. And so that from the Egyptian side, and you see things like Egyptians coming in with friends of theirs that are foreigners to show them, you know, this is Egyptian food, which was quite amazing. The other part of this that's been incredible has been the PR response, the press. We've been featured and gotten phenomenal reviews from Grub Street, Infatuation, Eater, I mean, many publications that we would have 3 years ago dreamt to even be mentioned as part of an article on. And to be getting reviews like that and critic reviews about our food and about the concept that are that positive has been just almost quite surreal.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about a concept that I know you're very familiar with and hear your views. We're seeing more and more of this sort of virtual food brands that are coming out. Cloud kitchens is a thing. Is that something you have considered? And if you wanted to hit sort of multiple boroughs, multiple even parts of Manhattan, would you consider going that route? And give us sort of your general view on that disruption that's happening through technology by a lot of brands considering virtual kitchens as part of their offering.
So in delivery in Egypt, to give you an idea, is about 60% of our business. We don't do it today with any virtual kitchens, but it's definitely something that we are looking at and very seriously assessing. In terms of the disruption of the space, I think I would say the disruption is coming more from just delivery in general than it is necessarily virtual or other types of kitchens. The economics of what a brick and mortar location looks like and changes dramatically when a lot of the consumption is starting to happen outside of the location. And I think, funnily enough, Egypt has had a head start on that. So
it's funny, I'm interrupting you say that. I remember growing up in Cairo as well, and McDonald's, I think we were one of the first countries to have McDonald's delivery.
The first, I think.
I think, which is either a testament to how lazy we are or just very ahead of our time, or a combination of the two. But anyway, it's just...
I think it's a crowded city, and the I'm convenience joking. Of getting things sent to your door in a city like Cairo is just a no-brainer.
And in the sense, New York is similar, because New York is also the essentially center of delivery in the U.S., right? I mean, I remember when I was living in New York, I mean, you could get, even 10 years ago, anything sent to you. When you're saying delivery is 60% of your business in Egypt, obviously in the U.S., it's still too early in New York to assess that, but do you envisage a similar trend in your New York location or multiple locations?
We do, and we are looking at it with the same type of aggression and believe, and looking at it as being a main avenue of growth for us. So we are looking at everything from ghost virtual kitchens to building our own kitchens that would also be virtual kitchens, but not as a shared kitchen model. The model today of having to open 50 flagship stores has changed. You can go into a city and instead of having to open 50 of them, you can open 5 now and have kitchens that are delivering for much less capex, much higher ROI, and much faster rollout throughout an entire neighborhood. Or through multiple neighborhoods throughout an entire city. So definitely, I think that this is, it's an exciting time for restaurants that can look at this as a new avenue of growth for them. I think it's also getting restaurant companies or restaurateurs in general to think about, okay, what's the difference between experience and the in-store and out-of-store experience.
Correct.
What is the experience of our proposition today? Is it convenience only, in which case how does the delivery cannibalize it, or do we have a strong enough proposition for people to come so that the delivery proposition is not actually cannibalizing the existing economics of the restaurant? There's so many different factors that come into this, but I think the reality of delivery and third-party delivery apps and just the consumer's interest to eat at home in general and order from restaurants is making for this sector being quite exciting over the next 10 years, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we've had a similar experience at the Lighthouse, and we were nervous about launching delivery about 6 or 7 months ago. And what we've found is, by and large, it has not cannibalized our actually kind of physical foot traffic. And then we have customers that we know are exclusively delivery customers. I mean, they come very, very rarely. They don't live super close to the physical location. So we've seen an expansion in that sense. But I wanted to ask you something related to that. There are now a number of models coming out in that virtual space. So one of the people we spoke to on this podcast very recently are the guys from Kitopi. And their model, for example, is they actually cook for you. You just give them the ingredients. Would you, as Zuba, consider a Kitopi-type model, or would you always want to be in the sort of kitchen yourselves?
It's a tough question. I think it comes back to the same conversation we've had even before delivery of just general franchising versus wholly owned growth. And I think it becomes a function of your faith in the partnership. Again, our obsession at the end of the day is with the food experience and the experience and the customer experience. We are control freaks in general, and I think controlling every part of the cycle from order to handing over the food for us makes us feel comfortable about the customer journey. And we're also very aware that we're in the business of hospitality, not food. And as a result, losing control over certain parts of it is concern over our brand in general. So it would really, it would be quite case specific and we'd have to know a lot about it. But as a general point, no, we prefer to control every part of it as much as we can.
Before we get into Chris's plans for the future of Zuba, let's go back to the current situation. I wanted to understand from Chris how he and the team have been working through the impact of these closures.
We started out with, like everyone else, just trying to figure out the magnitude of what we were dealing with. I think for us, coming to closure so quickly brought the magnitude, brought in perspective the magnitude of this quite immediately. And we very, very quickly started transitioning our thought process on if this is something that's going to last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, and in a worst case scenario, until there's a vaccine, which might be a year plus from now, how do we make sure that we still have a company and a brand after that? And went into intense cost-cutting measures, meeting after meeting, trying to figure out every single dime we can cut while protecting our team, protecting our culture, and protecting our brand, but still making sure that we survive and survive with enough capital after this is all done to go back into growth. So I think that process and that transition has been at the heart of everything that I think we've been doing and discussing at Zuba for at least the first 2 weeks since we closed. So probably second half of March, first week of April. Now we start to think of, okay, what's next? We're not going to be in the limbo survival mode for 12 months. We need to figure out again how we can transition the company to be, again, a growth company, even in these circumstances. And what does that mean for us? 100 team meetings and 1,000 emails and 500 strategy calls and discussions into this and examining every single possible outlet from, do you get into secondary lines of business or do you get into different types of revenue generating offerings that might be complementary to your business, retail, supermarkets, ready-made meal kits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so many. And I think we went full circle around this and kind of realized that a lot of the things that I think I had probably talked about 3 months ago when this was recorded at their core were the same growth strategies that we needed to come back and focus on in a much leaner and much more aggressive fashion to get through this. And that is, how do we build a value-based proposition that is convenient, that we can deliver to people's homes, that people can access and order through many different platforms? And how do we tell our brand story through different outlets that go beyond our four walls? And how can we aggressively continue to expand that to accommodate for people being more at home than they normally would? And that's kind of where we're at today with this. We're continuing to monitor this day at a time. We're in this constant struggle of figuring out the balance between culture, team, compassion, empathy, and survival, which is a combination of things that a month ago I never would have thought I had to make decisions on. How do you have a management team that takes enough of a sacrifice so they can survive, but they can allow a greater part of the team to make it through this? And when do you reopen, and when do you come back and make decisions that the safety of your employees are intact and that you can actually operate with a system in place that keeps everyone safe? Again, decisions that you never thought you'd be dreaming about just a month ago. But at the same time, how do you make sure that the livelihood of the whole team is still in place when a lot of the operations that we have are in a country that doesn't have a safety net in place, specifically Egypt? So it's been kind of a crazy time trying to navigate all these decisions. As I write this, we're closed across the board, but we're aggressively planning how we can open and how we can open safely and how we can open aggressively and compensate for the losses of income that we've had and potentially for the loss of a major part of our business for potentially a year, if not more, which is the dine-in part of the business, by succeeding at different other different channels, namely delivery, a new version of takeout that needs to be taking into consideration a new world of social distancing and space and safety. Yeah, and this is what we're currently working on and how we're viewing the company.
What do you aspire for Zuba to be if you would fast forward 10 years from now? Because obviously one of the things that this requires is patience, right? You've been doing this for 8 years. It takes time to build those kind of brands and those kind of organizations. So if we would fast forward another 8 years or 10 years, where would you like to see Zuba then?
I mean, our vision for Zuba is Zuba in every major city in the world. That's literally our stated vision on our website. I think for us, the passion here is about building and exporting and spreading something that has never been done before. My passion really comes from that. It's for me, it's not really financial. Actually, if we were to build the dream company in 20 years and I were to own 0.005% of it, I don't think I'd care very much. But I think building a world class business that is portraying our take on Egyptian street culture and Egyptian culture in a way that the world can see, that we can be proud of, is really our dream for that.
And can I push you on that? Because why would you not care? I mean, presumably, if you spent, I don't know, 30 years working on this, wouldn't you want to have sort of a meaningful, not only meaningful stake, but having felt that also financially it was sort of worth that effort?
It's a funny conversation, because I think that the transition from banking to starting up your own business, and one of the things that I early came to terms with is this idea that it's not a financial, you can't compare it in financial terms. If people are starting these businesses to compare whether they were going to make more money building a successful business versus having a career in X, Y, or Z, especially banking, it's generally going to be a losing battle. The time where I realized that this was really for me is when I really stopped caring about that comparison and didn't even think about it anymore. And for me, it was just about what was the next milestone of something special that we had accomplished. I think the reality of what we're doing is that there is financial reward for success. It's a for-profit business. So in some form or fashion, there will be financial reward for growing the business. But I don't have an obsession with completely controlling it. I made that decision early on that for me, it was about the growth, not about owning a majority of a business that I'm passing on to my kids. My kids can hopefully build their own futures. For me, it was about growing something special and growing it, even if I had less than 1% of it.
You're generally involved in a number of entrepreneurial organizations. You've been doing this now for 8 years. In your estimate, when you think about the kind of, there's no formula, obviously, but ingredients or building blocks necessary for someone to succeed today in this business, what would you rate as sort of, let's say, the three things? I mean, would it be the main things? Because there's so many things come into it. Is it talent? Is it luck? Is it capital raising ability, discipline? What would you think about?
Obviously, I think it's a combination of a lot of different things, of course, as you're saying. I would say I'd say a passion for building would be for me at the core of it. I think that in lots of instances, when I have conversations with people are interested in starting their own business because they love to cook, for example. So they want to start a restaurant business, or they, you know, love to sew. So they want to, I'm exaggerating, sure, of course, no, here, but so they want to start a clothing line. And I don't think that that's what entrepreneurship or that's what building these businesses is about. I think that actually success comes for people who love to build and love to build these organizations and have a passion for growing something. Lots of other things come into that. I think there's enormous patience that has to be a part of this, and grit. I mean, everyone overuses in every entrepreneurial conversation the word grit, but it's so true. There's no more emotional roller coaster than trying to start a company or build a company. But if I was trying to pinpoint something, I would just be that in the end of it, the product is very important, and all the different aspects of what you're actually offering are very important, but building it itself is what it really comes down to every day.
We hope you and your families are staying safe, and we hope that things will return back to normal in the next couple of weeks and months. Speaking to Chris just a few days ago, he told me that Zuba in Egypt is reopened for delivery. So there's light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully some good news very soon. You can find Zuba on Instagram at Zuba Eats and at Zuba for the New York location. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Lighthouse Conversations with me, Hesham Montasser. We're produced by Chirag Desai. You can find all our episodes in your favorite podcast player, where you can subscribe for free, and also check us out on the web at thelighthouse.ae/podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks. In the meantime, stay home and stay safe.